to capture your minds right now. Take you a little bit higher.
This is Indie Media on Air for the week of August 13, 2007. On today's show, EcoShock Radio talks about peak oil and suburbia with Canadian documentary filmmaker Gregory Green. Pambazooka News talks with Damien Ugwu of the Nigerian Civil Liberties Organization about torture and murder by the Nigerian police. We'll also get the latest Media Minutes update from Free Press. I'm Bronwyn Malden with the Los Angeles Independent Media Center. Once a month, Indie Media on Air highlights the work of independent media makers around the globe. Today's pieces come to us from Nigeria, Canada, and right here in the U.S. This is KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara. Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
In 2000, Congress authorized the FCC to issue low-power FM radio licenses to community groups and nonprofits. LPFM stations broadcast at 10 to 100 watts of power, covering about 3 to 5 miles. But when big media lobbyists complained that the tiny stations interfered with their full power signals, Congress limited LPFM to rural areas. Thousands of applicants were prevented from getting licenses to bring community radio to their region. But a taxpayer-funded study found that big broadcasters' claims of interference were vastly overstated. And now bipartisan support is growing for bills in the House and Senate that would allow LPFM stations to go on the air in cities and suburbs across the country. Hannah Sassaman of the Prometheus Radio Project explains.
When Congress passed that law, they also asked the FCC to study whether or not low-power FM radio would truly interfere with full-power FM broadcasts in a big city like Philadelphia or D.C. or Boston. The FCC came back with an independent $2.2 million study which proved, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that there was plenty of room for real community radio. In Omaha, Nebraska, groups like the 100 Black Men of Omaha and people affiliated with the local YMCA wanted community radio to train kids on essential job skills and sharing their voices with people across the city. They joined together with Methodist church activists, local Chamber of Commerce officials, and thousands of community members to convince Lee Terry, the Republican from Omaha, to join with a great advocate of media reform, Mike Doyle, the Democrat from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to introduce the Local Community Radio Act of 2007.
Low-power FM stations play a vital role in the community because they are so focused on local issues. People listen to it, and it can save lives. For instance, when Hurricane Katrina slammed into Mississippi, one of the handful of stations that continued to operate was WQRZ-LP.
The volunteers working at that station climbed their 130-foot tower to move their antenna and transmitter location to higher ground, and they kept on the air during the storm, and for the first 48 hours after the storm went through, they were the only link between all of Hancock County and the outside world.
This summer, LPFM activists will be visiting their representatives in their home states to urge them to support the Local Community Radio Act. Joe Torres, Government Relations Manager of Free Press.
We're doing in-district meetings with key members of the House Commerce Committee, which oversees telecom policy. We are asking constituents in the districts of about 20 representatives to actually take part in district meetings where they actually go and visit the congressperson, you know, asking them for their support for LPFM.
For more information, go to PrometheusRadio.org.
In New York City, the Mayor's Office of Film, Theater, and Broadcasting is redrafting a regulation that would have required photographers and filmmakers to get a permit and $1 million in liability insurance to shoot film and video in the city. The rules would have applied to any two people filming at a single site on public property for more than 30 minutes, or a crew of five or more people with a tripod filming on a site for more than 10 minutes. The onerous requirements would limit independent journalists and photographers, artists, tourists, and anyone interested in taking pictures in the most photographed city in the world. The mayor's proposed plan sparked a public outcry with an online petition that gathered more than 20,000 signatures, a First Amendment rally attended by 450 people, and even a rap video. The New York Civil Liberties Union threatened to file a lawsuit. Donna Lieberman, executive director of the NYCLU, said, "As with street demonstrations, people who are exercising their right to be on the sidewalk without interfering with pedestrian traffic should not be required under any circumstances to get government approval to take pictures." Catherine Oliver, the commissioner of the film office, said the rules will be revised based on the feedback the office has received, and a 30-day comment period will be opened after the new rules are published.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national, nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
The true energy revolution is going to be local, it's going to be distributed, it's going to be renewable and sustainable.
Canadian filmmaker Gregory Green has just completed his follow-up film to The End of Suburbia. That documentary explored the American way of life and its prospects as the planet enters the age of peak oil. His new documentary, Escape from Suburbia, takes up where the earlier film left off. Through personal stories of everyday citizens and interviews with scientific experts, Green examines how declining world oil production has already begun to affect modern life in North America. Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock News in Vancouver, British Columbia, recently spoke with Gregory Green about the film and why it's important.
If you ask the question, do we have a plan for what we're going to do when we reach peak oil? The answer is certainly no.
Someone driving through suburbia should take a good look around, record the memory, because we may never see anything like it again.
Let's talk with Gregory Green, the director of the new film Escape from Suburbia. Gregory, your last award-winning film was End of Suburbia. But around here, new housing developments are sprouting up, I have to tell you, like mushrooms further and further away. And we have some commuters shipping their cars by ferry, even commuting from what used to be called cottage country. So despite the gas prices almost doubling since 2004, people still don't seem to get the message. What do you think it's going to take?
Well, I mean, oil is still relatively inexpensive. I think today it's at $72 some odd, and if you look at a cup, it's still cheaper than a cup of coffee. It's got to get way more expensive. I think once we hit $100 or so, that will really start to engage the consumer.
$100 a barrel.
It's happening all over the place, you know. But here in Toronto, it's the same thing. There's sprawl, popping up all over the place.
Let's backtrack a little bit for people who missed the first film, the End of Suburbia. Why do you think suburbia is an endangered species, let's say?
Well, post-war suburbia was based on the conceit that we would always be driving cars and that there was lots of land to extend out into and lots of energy to power a very low-density way of life. So we in the sort of, the energy, the peak oil community, see the likelihood of that coming to an end as world production passes the peak and starts to, perhaps incrementally and slowly, but decline in any case. So that'll raise energy prices up and there'll be a big scramble for alternative energies. I think there's probably going to be a very serious recession or a series of recessions or worse. So all these things will put a real crimp on the suburban lifestyle.
And I guess another factor is everybody in China is either driving a car or wants to drive a car. We're going to have to compete with people that are actually producing something in other parts of the world.
Yeah, China and India are going to be huge competitors for the remaining oil and gas. And they don't seem inclined to start switching out to alternatives or you know, really looking very seriously at the energy equation. So I think there's going to be increasing competition for the resources that are left. It's the wild card. The wild card is, will there be war between, you know, the great powers again, with China allied with, you know, parts of Asia and Pakistan. America allied with, you know, other parts of Asia and India and, you know, some places in the Gulf, perhaps. The other possibility is even closer to that is a Middle Eastern war. I think war is the real wild card in this. The war is the possibility. The increasing potential of wars make it hard to predict whether the global economy is going to be the, you know, straw that broke the camel's back, or whether it's going to be fuel prices.
Well, you know, I watched your film last night, and it kept me up a little late afterwards asking a lot of questions, and I guess that means it's a good film. One of them I was wondering about was just that, but in fact, I had a different take. I was thinking, well, maybe since the military is using so much oil, almost as much as consumers are using, the U.S. military is anyway, that we might head towards a little bit of peace in the sense that they just won't have enough oil to keep all the tanks and airplanes and Navy ships going.
Well, that's pretty optimistic. I try to be an optimist, and I think we try to reflect some optimism in our new film. There's only so much you can push people, which we did in the first film, into a, you know, sort of a catastrophic scenario. In this film, we're trying to say, look, whatever happens, there are solutions. There's people working on the solutions, and there's lots of things we can do. Personally, though, I think that if it starts coming to military confrontation, we have lots of oil left. I think that's the main point here. We've only gone through about half of the remaining oil, and peak natural gas will be coming along in the next few years. So we've got lots to power the world's military machines, and I think that's likely to happen.
They'll probably keep getting it after our pumps run dry because they have the power to enforce it.
Yeah. I don't know that our pumps are going to run dry anytime soon. Again, it's going to be the price. It's going to be, there may be scarcity, I don't know. But the price, I just don't know any thinking person looking at this who can't see the potential for skyrocketing prices. And I think that's the danger to consumers in the immediate future.
We have a lot of surprising people coming out on this issue now. I was wondering, former Governor General Ed Schreier was there, and he's worried we're going to run out of oil before we do anything about it. That was in your film.
A lot of the energy experts aren't worried about running out of oil anytime soon. Peak oil only means that you've used about a half of it. The danger is that the transition to the various forms of energy we're going to be replacing oil and gas with. The danger is we'll be doing that transition in a period of economic contraction and wars. So it's the transition. It's not running out that's the big danger. It's the transitioning to all these other forms of energy that's going to be the tough part.
And some of them take decades to develop.
All these various alternative energies take decades to develop. Right now, we're moving towards biofuels, and it's what we tried to talk about in our documentary, but, you know, the news is coming out all over the place for those who are inclined to hear it. The consequences of switching to biofuels are enormous. We're going to be producing less food, switching our food crops to power our vehicles. There's barely enough food in the world to feed the population now. World wheat production has been going down for the last few years. We've been going through our reserves, and we don't know if we've hit peak grain, but that's a possibility too. So, you know, the further consequences of going to biofuels is we're going to be really pushing out the marginal groups around the world that are dependent on those crops to eat.
In other words, some people may starve so we can keep filling up our gas tanks.
That's happening already. People are hungry. As you know, over the last 2 years, we've seen this you know, shift to biofuels. There were riots in Mexico City last year over the price of corn tortillas because the price of corn has tripled in the last few years, and the biofuel revolution hasn't even begun yet. So we see the writing on the wall there.
Well, you know, I come at this more from an environmentalist perspective, I have to say, and we do a lot of programs on climate change. And we see that in the Amazon, for example, they're bulldozing parts of the rainforest that we need very much, releasing a lot of carbon in order to plant soya for biofuels.
Yeah, we're using up one of the last biggest carbon sinks on the planet in Brazil and other countries to do that.
And I see in your film you have David Suzuki speaking out about peak oil, too.
Yeah, you know, it's very odd. The leadership of the progressive environmental movement or the progressive left movement have been really mum on the issue of oil depletion and peak oil. I don't really know why. I think a lot of them have been so focused on climate change. And so maybe, you know, peak oil is kind of like the new kid on the block in some respects. The other thing is, I think, coming from a lot of the progressive movement is that a lot of people who are focused on the peak oil issue tend to be not environmentalists. They haven't been focused on climate change. They tend to be very conservative energy analysts and stockbrokers and financial people. So I think the two sides view each other with extreme distrust, whereas it's the same issue. It's our, you know, as President Bush said, it's our addiction to oil. So it's really, and this is what we tried to do in Escape from Suburbia. It's important for us to reach out and talk about climate change at the same time as we talk about peak oil and energy scarcity.
Yes, you had both Thomas Homer Dixon and the Green Party leader Elizabeth May talking about the possible convergence and the resistances of these two issues. Elizabeth May seemed to be suggesting that fossil fuels like coal and tar sands are going to outlast the ability of the climate to survive it, so that even if peak oil is an important issue, climate change may threaten us before we use up the last of the fossil fuels. What's your take on that?
Well, I think I sort of disagreed with what Elizabeth May said in our documentary. At a certain point, she says peak oil can't happen fast enough for climate change. The thinking going is, as we hit peak, then we'll just be using less fossil fuels. But I think the danger is that as we hit peak and we've used up the easily available oil and gas, we're going to be switching to the dirtier hydrocarbons. The danger is very clear that way, because if we're doing this, during a period of a Middle Eastern war or more tension between the great powers, economic recessions or a depression, then people are going to be desperate to put the lights on any way they can. So the danger as we pass peak is that we will be exacerbating climate change, and that's a very real danger. So
one of the things I really liked about your film was that I didn't come away with it thinking that you had all the answers and I was supposed to, at the end of the film, get your answer. Just the fact right now you just said, well, I disagreed with something that was in my own documentary. It indicates that you really did cover a lot of different points of view and then left it for the viewer to sort it out. Well, what am I going to do?
This was the conundrum we were facing in the second documentary, is lots of people were really waiting for us to give them the answers. And I think we started out the film that way. I had things that I wanted to discuss and be much more sort of technical about it. That doesn't really lead to a very interesting dramatic arc in a film. That was one issue. But the other issue that happened over the last 2 years is that just a plethora of information started coming out about what we can do about, you know, sustainable solutions. Here in Toronto, the Toronto Star has fantastic articles every day about you name it, you know, the 100-mile food movement, local eating, new solar technologies, green power, all these things. So it became clear to me that the answers were out there. You just need the will to do that, and you need to be talking with other people to compare the information that you're gathering, because the information's there. Who are we to sort of give a short list of the possible solutions when other people are doing fantastic work on it? We touched on that, of course, at the end of the film, the fact that, you know, the true energy revolution is going to be local, It's going to be distributed. It's going to be renewable and sustainable. But yeah, it was very difficult trying to carve a story that would engage people out of all the sort of sustainability answers that are coming out. It was tough. But yeah, I don't agree with everything we said in the film. But I think it's a template for discussion. That's the whole thing. Like the first film, this film is designed to bring people who are concerned about energy scarcity, about peak oil, about climate change, together and just get them talking.
And I thought it was gentle enough that if people got the DVD and played it for a bunch of friends, some of whom may have never even heard of peak oil, that discussion would take place. Is that part of your intent?
Yeah, absolutely. The discussion is to get as many people talking about this as possible. But again, the overarching importance I see of the film is to sort of give people a sort of solid sense of the convergence of these problems that are coming together, a sense that there are many answers coming from a lot of different directions, and that people are really sincere about trying to address them. The three characters we have, the character couples that we have in our film, aren't meant to be, you know, Mr. Every Person. And we've been criticized for that. I think people want to see a sort of nice white suburban family, you know, buying solar panels and planting food. We wanted to show people who are thinking outside the box and in some cases marginalized. The gay couple in New York are a pretty kind of marginalized demographic within the peak oil community. There's not, you know, a lot of gay folks around. Kate Holloway, our activist in Toronto, is not.
Well, she's a former business person who has really just done a 180. And said, well, I'm going to go green and dig in and do the best where I am. That's quite a turnaround.
Well, I'm glad that was clear in the film. That's what's important about her character, certainly, is that she's a lot more mainstream than the other two characters.
Mm-hmm.
But again, we didn't want to pander to that idea that we should be presenting, you know, the public with one particular story that has all the answers.
You've been listening to my interview with Gregory Green, the director of Escape from Suburbia. And hang on, there's more to come. We've got lots more discussion with Gregory Green.
It could easily be one of the awful tipping points in the history of the world.
I think there's many ways to survive and even thrive in the coming energy decline.
You're listening to an interview with filmmaker Gregory Green, director of the documentary Escape from Suburbia. We'll be back in a moment with the rest of the interview. Later in the show, we'll hear from Nigerian human rights activist Damien Ugwu about torture and murder by the Nigerian police. This is Indie Media On Air on KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara. Stay tuned.